Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
I recommend it. If you've never been, right, it's something that you might regret. It's certainly a unique atmosphere, that is for sure. So, here we are this evening, and what we're really here is to hear this gentleman who's sitting on my right. So, Anthony Peake is somebody that's been on the circuit for a long time. He gives some of the most stunning talks I've ever seen over the years. And it's all about the mind, and it's all about being so much more capable of things that we just take for granted, maybe. This is an extraordinary thing. And consciousness, and even the possibility of consciousness existing outside of this world, these are all things that Anthony has written about extensively. And tonight we're here to talk about how to open the doors of perception. So I'd like to give you, or give him, a really big hand. So, Anthony Peake, welcome.
I was going to post something on Facebook. I was about to take a photograph of the audience and turn around and say, I would like to believe in the next 90 minutes these people's minds will be blown. I thought that was a bit too anticipatory because it might end up being thinking, no, not at all. Anyway, the book I'm going to be talking about today is called Opening Doors of Perception, and it was published around about 3 years ago. I've spent today writing about the sequel, which will be in the bookshops and on Amazon on Jandar, December 10th this year. And this will be my 11th book. So far in terms of my book sales around the world, I've been fairly reasonable. I've sold over 100,000 books. My books are in every single European major language, and indeed a lot of the minor languages of Europe as well. So my work has a certain undercurrent. Now, you might find my approach slightly different, in the sense that my approach is entirely scientific. If you read my books, you'll find that every single reference I give you, I will report you straight with you, I will take you straight back to academic papers. I work under the concept that extraordinary claims need extraordinary proofs, which is a statement made by a guy called Marcello Truby many, many years ago. And I think it's very true, because I do make extraordinary claims. But my extraordinary claims are based upon actual science and peer-reviewed papers. So don't take my word for anything I'm saying here. Check it out and read it up for yourself and make your own conclusions. Those are the things I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm hoping if I can run through the talk, we'll probably have a question and answer session at the end, which I always find the most enjoyable part of my talks. I also tend to talk, lecture by walking about. So I might have to get rid of this mic and actually walk around because I find that I'm just being restricted a little bit. So that's okay. I will do that. Yeah, that's best. I feel more at ease now. It's the rock star in me. Right, okay. This is the book, Opening the Doors of Perception. The reason I chose the words opening the doors of perception, there are two strands to this. The first one is a statement from a poem by William Blake. And it says, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. Now what William Blake was trying to convey there was the way in which he perceived the world. Now I don't know if you know a great deal about William Blake, but he was a fascinating poet, London poet in the 18th century. And a lot of his poems are extremely strange and extremely curious, as are indeed his drawings and his paintings, because he believed that he actually saw spirits. He saw things that weren't there. And he argued that we do not see what is really happening because our mind is closed. And it is only under certain circumstances when the doors of perception are cleansed, we'll see the universe as it really is.
We jump forward. Okay.
The idea that the brain in some way is an attenuator, that is, it takes out information, was first really put across by a man called Henri Bergson, who was a French philosopher. And Bergson argued that what is actually taking place, as we have evolved, is that our brains attune us to survive in this environment. So in other words, if I was able to hear everything that was happening and see everything that was happening and sense everything that was happening, I wouldn't last very long. Because if I'm somebody with a saber-toothed tiger in front of me, I've got to deal with the situation and run very, very quickly. It is little point that I can remember everything that's happened in my life, and it's a little point that I can actually attune to everything that's happening all around me. You have to run. You have to survive. He argued that the brain ordinarily does this. It locks us in. Now, one of the analogies I've used in the past about this is how we perceive the visual world around us. Now, the reason you can see at the moment and what you're seeing is effectively tiny particles, tiny points of electromagnetic energy called photons are bouncing off my body and are entering your eye. These photons go through your eye, go through your aqueous humor, and then they attach themselves to the retina on the back of the eye. Now the retina is postage stamp sized and it is inverted. And what happens is a postage stamp inverted image is converted to an electrical signal, which then goes to the back of your head, down here, in the visual cortex. Something magical then happens, and that image is then recreated by the brain. Remember, it's postage stamp sized, it's bent, and it's inverted. And it creates what you're seeing now. A three-dimensional, completely surround image that is not bent, is not inverted, and is not postage stamp sized. And that you are doing every second, all the time when you're perceiving things. This in itself is intriguing, but of course what is even more intriguing is what is inside your head that's actually doing the perceiving in the first place. Because that's a whole other question. So what we see is not necessarily what's out there. Now I mentioned the photons of light, the little particles. Each photon of light can only ever travel at the speed of light. It doesn't accelerate to the speed of light, it can only travel at the speed of light. Einstein told us that if an object is traveling at the speed of light, time does not exist. So from the point of view of these little photons that are hitting your eyes, there is no difference from that photon's point of view from the moment it was first created. Many of the photons were actually created around about 13 billion years after the Big Bang. But from the point of view of that photon, there is no time difference at all. On top of that, photons are called point particles. A point particle means it has no extension in space. It is literally a point. So suddenly, the things we think we are seeing, and the things that are making us see, are suddenly starting to disappear in a puff of scientific smoke. But then it gets odder. Much odder. Because the electromagnetic spectrum, light, visible light, is just a very, very small part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And in one of my early books, I wanted to try and get across just exactly how restricted we are in what we see. I decided that I would make out that the electromagnetic spectrum, that is from radio waves to gamma waves, if that was the Mississippi River, running from a little lake in northern Minnesota all the way through central United States of America, coming out at the Gulf of Mexico. What we think is the visual world is an inch and a half, about 18 miles south of Hannibal, Missouri. The rest of it we do not see. We cannot see. It is beyond our comprehension. Bees can actually see into the infrared. But that's about it. So most creatures do not perceive the full reality. But we perceive, because we see colours the way we see them, and because we see things the way we see them, we believe that is how it is. It's not. Your brain is programmed to see the things that you're supposed to see. We talk about colours, about the colour red. The colour red exists nowhere. There is no such thing as red. Everything is black. The only reason it's red is because the photons, the electromagnetic energy that's hitting a red jumper, it effectively soaks in all the electromagnetic signals and wavelengths except for the red wavelength, and that bounces back off the jumper. And then you see the red. But the red is nowhere. In fact, have you ever tried to explain red to a blind person? Have you ever tried to explain what red is like to somebody else? You can't. You can only say it's a bit like orange and it's not like blue. But we don't know what red is. Also, apparently, and I discussed this with my optometrist a few years ago, at the back of your eye is something called a blind spot. It's where the optic nerve leaves the back of the eye. You don't see it, even though you have a blind spot right in the middle of your visual field. You don't see it. I was talking to my optician about this, and I said, isn't it fascinating? And he said, no, it's not fascinating at all. Why do you think it's fascinating? We have binocular vision, that's why we have two eyes. When you have two eyes, the two images overlap, like a set of binoculars, and it overlaps, and the blind spot disappears. And I went to him and I said, isn't that fascinating? So what happens when I close one eye then? And he went, oh. And I said, you never thought of that, had you? And he said, no, I hadn't. I said, you were talking about it at university, weren't you? Yes, and you've always accepted it as fact, haven't you? Well, it's not a fact, is it? No, it's not really. Because it is, you know, we do not see the blind spot. This is because the brain makes up the information. It presents the information to you to give you a clear vision. So that's a little bit of background as to the idea of how what we think is real is not necessarily real. You're all sitting on chairs at the moment and you'll possibly think you're in contact with the chairs. And the chairs are solid. Chairs and everything physical in the universe is 99.9999999999 empty space. Fact. The reason you don't fall through your chair is not because you're sitting on the chair, it's because of something called the electrostatic force, which is the repulsion because your backside is negative and the chair is negative and you hover above it. You never touch anything. You never really see anything and you never really touch anything. So what you think is physical reality out there is not. The amount, for instance, 94% of the universe is missing. 94%. It's dark matter and dark energy. It's called dark matter and dark energy because we have not got a clue what it is. But we know it's there. And we know it's there because of the way galaxies revolve. For instance, if you turn around and you take a piece of rope and you put a weight on the end of it and you start spinning around, you lift the weight off and you start spinning, you will spin very, very slowly if the weight is at a distance. But as you pull the weight towards you, you start to spin faster. Galaxies do the complete opposite. Galaxies, the further out you are, the slower things are. Which means effectively that there's weight and there's mass around the galaxies that we don't know what it is. Dark energy is the same. There's also something called the quantum vacuum. There are subatomic particles that actually jump in and out of reality. This again is a known fact. If you ask a quantum physicist, they will tell you. Another point. Your act of observation creates what's around you. It's called collapsing the wave function. Before a subatomic particle is measured or perceived, it is a probability wave. It is a wave of probability that it may be in one location or another. The act of measurement and the act of observation makes that subatomic particle choose to be in one place or another. If you're not looking at it, it's not there. Do you ever remember Einstein made a very famous phrase many years ago? Check it up on the web, it's quite a famous one. He said, I cannot believe that the moon is not there when I'm not looking at it. The reason he said that is because of something called the Copenhagen Interpretation of Quantum Physics, put forward by a group of scientists in, believe it or not, Copenhagen in Denmark, led by a guy called Niels Bohr. And these guys actually showed that reality is brought about by the act of measurement or the act of observation. So suddenly your world is starting to be falling apart. Suddenly the things you think that are all nice and solid and real suddenly aren't. But this is all being processed by your brain. And it's processed by your brain and it's presenting to whatever you are in your head the information from outside. So let's start thinking about what's inside your head. Well, we know that there's neurons, and there's glial cells, and there's electricity, and there's neurochemicals and neurotransmitters in your brain. Where are you? Where are you in all that? Where do you appear out of this mess of electrical signals and physical matter?
Do you come about because there's the addition of one microbe, is the addition of one atom that makes you come about? So all your hopes, your dreams, your memories that are carrying in your head at the moment, everything that makes up you is just created by electricity reacting with matter in your brain. It's called the hard problem of science. Science has no idea how the brain creates consciousness. None at all. Check up the work of a guy called David Chalmers, who was an Australian philosopher who made this statement back in 1999. It is the greatest mystery. We know how the brain functions, we know what bits of the brain do what, but we don't know how it creates consciousness. So that's setting up the position where Henri Bergson was arguing that there's something very, very strange about the human brain. I use the title The Doors of Perception based upon this book called The Doors of Perception, written by Aldous Huxley in 1954. Some of you will probably know Aldous Huxley as a writer, and a writer of fiction, but he was also an extremely interesting guy. He was going blind. As he was getting older, he started to lose his sight. So he was quite fascinated by sight and how sight works. And around about December 1953, he read an article that had been written by an English psychiatrist called Humphrey Osmond. And Humphrey Osmond was working at a huge hospital in Saskatchewan in Canada. Apparently the largest building in the British Empire at the time was a, can I use the term lunatic asylum? I suppose I could, because that's what they were known at the time. But it was the largest building in the British Empire. And what Osmond had been doing is, he'd been using various substances with people who had schizophrenia. And he was particularly using mind-altering substances such as peyote or mescaline. Because what he discovered, and this is quite fascinating, that if somebody is experiencing schizophrenia, they see things, their mind is working to the dozen, they're seeing hallucinations, they're hearing voices and everything else. Osmond realized that if you gave somebody like that an hallucinogenic substance, their actual hallucinations would cease to be as powerful. The hallucinogenic substance seemed to stop the hallucinations. He was so intrigued by this, or Huxley was so intrigued by this, and the effects that these particular substances had, that he wanted to try it for himself. And he contacted Osmond and said, can you fly down to California, where he was then living, and bring some mescaline with you? Now, mescaline peyote is actually made from cactus. It's a kind of cactus leaf substance. He then took some of this substance. And again, if you take the opportunity to read the book, Opening the Doors of Perception, it really is incredible. Because he describes in there what happened to him when he took peyote for the first time. And he said suddenly his literal doors of perception were blown right off the hinges. He suddenly could see things in greater detail. He spent hours staring at the carpet. He could see things that he could never see before. And I'm reminded there was a German philosopher, Jakob Bohme, who many years ago said you could go insane by just looking at a pewter dish. Because this is it, we don't focus in on reality in that way, do we? We tend to live our lives and we're rushing around. But these substances make you stop and look at something and just stare at something in great intensity. And he became really intrigued by this, so he wrote Doors of Perception. Now, what I have done in my new book, I've called it Opening the Doors of Perception. Because what I've done is I've taken the ideas of Huxley and I've updated them, taking into account what we now know about neurology, what we know about neurochemistry, what we know about how the human brain works, and said, well, what have we learned? What do we know that's different about altered states of consciousness that we didn't know in 1954? This, again, as the point I touched upon before, is the hard problem, and I'll just reiterate this. David Chalmers is a really fascinating guy. He's one of these kind of hippie philosophers. And some of his ideas are quite staggering. And again, if you get the opportunity, if you read The Conscious Mind in Search of a Fundamental Theory, he really goes into great detail of exactly what we mean when we talk about consciousness, which are the things I just pointed on before. So, if consciousness just spontaneously occurs in the brain, magically comes as of from nowhere, where does it come from? consciousness, actually what is, as the scientists call it, an epiphenomenon of brain behavior? Or is it something far deeper? Is consciousness something that is outside of us that we are tuning to? Now, nothing original about the point I'm going to be making now. And it's been made many, many times, including by Tesla here. Your brain, the evidence is more and more that your brain is a receiver. I use the analogy of, we're all probably old enough in the audience to remember valve radios. You know, those kind of things with a little dial when you turn them around and everything else from the early 60s. If you took the back of a valve radio, what you would see, you'd see lots of valves and lots of lights and lots of heat coming out. And coming out the front would be the sound of the arches. And you'd be listening to the arches. Now, using the same analogy that science uses, that consciousness is literally just the brain, it is like looking at a radio and assuming that all the actors in the arches and the Archer studio are all in the radio. So what do? You take the back off the radio and you start fiddling around with the valves. And suddenly the Archer disappears. Have you killed the actors? No. It's a recording in a studio. But we believe that because you start fiddling around with the back of the brain, or the brain itself, and somebody dies, you assume that the person has gone. But what has happened is the receiver has ceased to function. It doesn't mean that the person has ceased to function at all. It just means the receiver isn't receiving the message anymore. That is just as useful an explanation as anything else. And this is what Tesla believed. Now the question is, if the human brain is a receiver, first point is, how does it do the receiving? What is going on here? And in the book, I go through this in great detail. I discuss something called OROR, that's Orchestrated Objective Reduction. It is actually the background to this, is, yeah, no, I can move on. No, I'll explain this quickly and then I'll explain OROR. Your brain is full of neurons. There are literally billions of neurons in your brain. These are long cells, okay? Within each neuron are literally millions of tiny structures called microtubules. And the microtubules are the things that actually help your neuron structure, because your neurons can be very, very long and thin, and they can spread quite long distances across the brain. And they need to have a structure. So these things are made of tubulin. There are literally so many of them within each of your neurons of your brain. So if you do the math, you're suddenly starting to discover there's an awful lot of these things in your brain. Now, I'll discuss a little bit more about how they work. But let's just go a little bit back to the people who have come up with the orchestrated objective reduction idea. These are not the guys down the pub. These are not some kind of new age loony. These are serious researchers. Professor Roger Penrose is the Rouse Ball Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge. He's one of the world's most famous mathematicians and a fantastic theoretical physicist. The other guy who's come up with the idea is Professor Stuart Hammerhoff, who is Professor of Anesthesiology at the University of Arizona. The reason that both these guys are interested in this is for one very peculiar fact. Have any of you ever had an operation where you've been put out completely? Do you recall how strange that is? It's not like a dream. You go and then you come to again. It's as if a whole section of your life has been taken out. This is what fascinated Hammerhoff. As an anesthesiologist, he knows exactly what chemicals and exactly what structures can be placed into the brain to cause unconsciousness. But what he was interested in is why it causes unconsciousness. And I've spoken to many, many doctors about this. Nobody knows why this does what it does. Nobody knows why anesthetics work. They don't know why it is. They destroy, literally, your conscious awareness. It's as if it kind of takes you out of this reality completely. Hammerhoff has come to the conclusion, as with Roger Penrose when they worked together, that the reason it does it, it disrupts the signal. It disrupts the consciousness signal that's coming from somewhere else. And the two of them have argued that the consciousness signal actually is coming up from the quantum vacuum, from what's called the zero-point field. the quantum vacuum, the energy of the universe. Zero point energy is a form of energy that exists where there is no energy. It's called zero point. It's called literally zero point because it's the way a pendulum moves, and there's a certain point where a pendulum is at the zero point. But that's not the point that I'm going to be making now about zero point energy. What I'm going to be saying is that zero point energy is discovered if you take a substance down to just above absolute zero. Now heat, all heat is energy, and we feel it as heat. But there is a point where there's no more energy in the system, and that's called absolute zero, which I think is 242.113 degrees zero, below zero, or zero Kelvin. It's zero because there is no energy there. However, there's a form of helium called helium-4 that you can take down to up to about a 10,000th of a degree above absolute zero. It still continues to be liquid. It doesn't freeze. There's an energy coming from somewhere, and they don't know where it is and what it is. There's also another reason for zero point energy, and if any scientists in the room, you will know exactly what I mean by this. It's to do with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You cannot know the location and velocity of a subatomic particle. You cannot know both. But if you were in a situation of zero energy, you would know the location of the particle, and you would know it wasn't moving. And that contravenes one of the great laws of quantum physics. But that's just as a side as any scientists in the room who are wondering exactly where I was going with this, but it's because it contravenes Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. What they argue is that there is this energy that's there, and that it can be attuned in. And they argue that, I've got a pointer here, doesn't matter. Is that it? Yeah, there it is. What they do is, well, modern technology. By the way, using that is even an example. Lasers are quite fascinating things. Lasers are actually what are called a Bose-Einstein condensate, which I'll actually come to a bit later on, actually. That's quite useful. What happens is that the single photons of light come from either side of the inside of microtubules, which means they cause inside of themselves very tiny interference patterns where the light interferes with itself. Now again, any scientists in the room or anybody that knows anything about holograms, well, no, that's what a hologram is. It's an interference pattern. Your brain is full of trillions and trillions of tiny little things creating interference patterns. Is that what reality really is? Is that what we perceive when we see the reality outside of ourselves? Is it our brain creating it for us in some bizarre way? Or is it taking information from somewhere else and downloading it into our brains in exactly the way that, say, the internet is downloaded into your computer every day? Well, let's move on and just see whether this is a possibility. Well, there's certainly some very, very strange things that take place in the brain. Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is literally where microtubules in the brain are destroyed and exploded by things called amyloid plaques. And they flow through the brain and they literally blow up the microtubules. Now let's think about this. Remember I used the analogy before about the valve in the back of the radio? Is what's taking place in Alzheimer's that what is happening is the valves are being destroyed and you can't get the signal anymore? Is that why your memories start to go? That's why you get confused? That's why your reality starts to act strangely? And it does act strangely, by the way, which we will discover in a few seconds. So suddenly, we're starting to get a pattern here. Michael Persinger, who died recently, was a professor of psychology at the Laurentian Institute in Sudbury in Ontario in Canada. He's been able to reproduce in people altered states of consciousness by putting on something he calls the God Helmet. And the God Helmet actually sends out certain levels of vibrations into the temporal lobes of the brain, which brings about what's called the sense presence. It also makes people feel that they're floating outside of their body and various other peculiar phenomena. So you can stimulate these things in the brain. And of course they will argue this is proof that the brain is just a processor. I would say it's the opposite. I'm saying the passenger signals are actually processing the brain to actually allow the brain to access broader areas of consciousness and broader areas of reality. Has anybody had sleep paralysis? Okay. Sleep paralysis, for everybody who has not ever had it, is you wake up in the night and you're semi-awake and semi-sleep and you cannot move. Very, very terrifying. The reason it happens is comparatively simple. If you're dreaming and you are in a fight in the dream, you're going to fling your arms out and about. You're going to damage yourself or you're going to injure somebody else who's next to you. So what the body does is a very clever thing. It paralyzes you. When you're dreaming, it stops you being able to move, which is all well and good, except if you wake up in this state. And if you wake up, you're going to feel like you can't move. But the question is if you are still in a state of dreaming. And people, when they get into this state, usually see things. They usually see something called the hag, which is normally a cowled figure sitting in the corner of the bedroom. If anybody is an art historian or anybody loves art, you probably know the painting by a guy called Fuseli, called A Nightmare. And it's a lady lying on a bed like this, and there's a little creature sitting on her chest. Does anybody know the painting? Has anybody seen it? Okay, check it out, it's very interesting. It's also a joke, because if you look at the painting, you will look and see that behind the lady there's a window, and there's a white horse with its head coming through the window. That's The Nightmare, which is quite clever and quite witty. But nevertheless, you feel like you can't move. You feel like you're trapped in your body. It's something called REM intrusion, is the technical term. It's when you are in REM sleep, you are in dreaming sleep, but you are awake as well. And the dream seems to be out there rather than inside your head. Okay? Now, the reason I'm telling you about this is this. This is my mother. Around about 9-10 years ago, when she was in her mid-80s, she lives alone, lives in a comparatively isolated village on the Wirral in the northwest of England. And her and my father's sister became very good friends after they both lost their husbands. So my aunt would actually come round and stay with my mother. And they were both walking onto, my mother phones me up the one evening, and she says, something quite curious happened when we were walking home last night. And I said, what? And she said, your auntie Audrey had stopped to tie her shoelace. Now, my mother had lost one eye with malignant melanoma about 10 years before. And she had glaucoma in the other, so she was partially sighted. But she said she looked over my aunt, and she could see what she described as being a ring of smoke over a derelict factory nearby. And she said she looked at it, and it started to spin. And then she said she saw it shot up in the direction of North Wales at great speed. Now, I know she saw this, and I know she saw this for a reason. Because I posted the story you're about to hear on Facebook about 6 years ago. And there was a friend of mine called Morgan Hawkins who contacted me because she said she was on a bus on the A41 that day, and she saw the object flying in exactly the same direction that my mother said she saw. So this was a physical object out there in three-dimensional reality. Whatever my mother saw, it was real. So she tells me about it. I said, oh, well, you know, probably your eyesight, you know, who knows. So my aunt then goes back home, and it's about 3 days later, and one morning, I get a phone call from my mother. She's in a state of absolute hysteria. I said, well, what's your problem? And she said, you're not going to believe it. It was awful. And I said, what happened? And she said, I woke up last night at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I know I closed my bedroom door. The door was open, but I couldn't move. She had sleep paralysis. And she said, but I then looked at the door, and three tiny spindly fingers came round the door, and this creature popped its head round the door. And she said it had huge black eyes. She said it had a slit for a mouth and two small holes for nostrils. It looked at me, it blinked, and it dodged back again. Tony, what the hell had I seen? Now, I've been fascinated by the UFO phenomenon since I was 10 or 11 years of age. My mother doesn't know anything about UFOs. She knows nothing about grades. She knows nothing about the archetypes at all. It has never interested her in any shape or form. She had seen a grey. She had seen a grey 2 or 3 days before she had seen a UFO in the sky. Now, this amazed me, and I'm thinking, what is going on here? There's something peculiar here. Sleep paralysis is fascinating because this is what people see. This was a painting done by somebody with sleep paralysis. But it gets weirder. Because a few weeks later, I go to see my mother, and she turns around and she's sitting in the living room and she goes, the children aren't singing as much to me these days. And I said, what children? And she said, the children that follow me when I'm shopping and the children that sit and sing to me when I'm watching the television. And she goes, I don't know if they really are children. They're kind of little people. And they run around my legs. And they sometimes pull at my clothes and they sing to me. And then she said, but they're not as friendly as the old man in the kitchen. He's very friendly. He always smiles at me when I go into the kitchen. Now I'm thinking, is she inviting old men in from next door? Is she letting children in from the village? And then I realised, no, she's not. Because I know enough about psychology and unusual altered states of consciousness to realise exactly what was happening to my mother. She was developing something called Charles Bonnet syndrome. Has anybody heard of Charles Bonnet syndrome? Okay. Charles Bonnet syndrome takes place with people who are partially sighted when they get older. It's as if the brain is accommodating the fact that they can't see things by projecting hallucinations outside into their external environment. That is the official explanation. That is what I call the labeling theory of science, i.e. give it a label, and you've explained it. Call it an hallucination. Start digging, and you find nobody has a clue what causes hallucinations. Not at all. A guy called Oliver Sacks wrote a book on hallucinations many years ago. One of the world's top psychiatrists. And he actually said, we do not know what hallucinations are. So here we have something taking place to an elderly lady. And I thought, this is very, very odd. I took her to the doctors and I managed to get a diagnosis of Charles Bonnet syndrome and also a diagnosis of the start of Alzheimer's. Sadly, my mother died of Alzheimer's around about 8 or 9 months ago. But as an aside, and this is an aside, I don't normally do this on the talks, but one of the stories that really stunned me, and this really shook me, and it really proves one of the elements of my earlier books, is that my mother went into a home, and one day I get a phone call from the home, and my mother had been semi-catatonic for about 6 months. She hadn't spoken or done anything. I could hear her in the background screaming at the people, talking to them, and they said, can you speak to your mother, please, because she's in a state of hysteria here. And I said, what, she's speaking? And they said, yes, we're quite surprised. She suddenly started being active. So we hang the phone over, and my mother turns around to me, and it sends shivers down my spine now. She turns around and she goes, Tony, oh, thank God you rang me. She said, these people have got me prisoner. She said, I don't know what happened. She said, she said, I was sitting watching Morgan and Wise on television, and I closed my eyes to take 40 winks, and I've woken up, and I'm in this place, and I don't know who they are or why they've got me imprisoned. When your father finds out about this, I'm going to sue. And then she goes, you're not Tony. And I said, yes, Sam. She goes, no, you're an older man. My son is 21. He's away at university. And I said, no, it's me. She goes, no, it's not. Where my father is. And she slammed the phone down. I managed to phone her back, and we managed to calm her down. And then she went back into catatonia. Just imagine a scenario that was going on in her head. Could it be really the fact that she'd been sitting in 1974 watching Morgan and Wise, and she closed her eyes and then suddenly found that she'd awoken and she was a little old lady and she was trapped in a home with all these strange people, and then her son phones and it's not her son anymore? I don't know if anybody's ever seen the film Awakenings. It was a group of people who had Parkinson's disease. Sleeping sickness. in the 1920s, and they found a drug called L-DOPA in the 1950s, which allowed them to wake up again. This is what happened to these people. They went to sleep in the 1920s as teenagers and woke up as elderly people in the 1950s. With no bit between the dates, it was as literally as if they closed their eyes and they'd woken up again. The term that happened to my mother was called terminal lucidity. Now again, if anybody's interested, an associate of mine is a lady called Maggie Latterell. And Maggie Latterell has written a book, which I cite in my book, about her own mother's decline into Alzheimer's. Some of the things that were taking place in Maggie Latterell's mother's life is absolutely uncanny. I will give you just one example. Maggie was going to be travelling up to see her mother, who was in a home in Western Scotland, in Ayr. And on the Friday, she was had her friend round at her house. And her friend said, well, whereabouts did you used to live in Scotland? And Maggie said, well, let's get on Google Earth. So she switched on Google Earth, and they zoomed into the house. And in the drive of Maggie's mother's house was Maggie's red Mini. And Maggie said, oh, that's really interesting. I haven't had that Mini for about a year or two. And they had a chat about her red Mini. Maggie then gets in the car, a new car, and drives up to Scotland. Goes into the home, goes into her mother's room, and her mother's sitting looking out of the window. And as Maggie walked in, she said, Maggie's Mini, talking about Maggie's Mini, we're talking about Maggie's Mini. And Maggie's thinking, Mum, how do you know I've been talking about the Mini? Maggie's Mini, Maggie's Mini. This is one of at least six occasions where her mother proved that she was completely aware of things that was impossible to be aware of. This is because Alzheimer's starts to break down the doors of perception. As you start to approach, the amyloid plaques are being destroyed, but what is taking place is the doors of perception are being opened. And this is what takes place. If you have the misfortune of having a parent or somebody close to you that has Alzheimer's, watch and listen to what they say. Maggie's mother turned around and said, the people keep coming in, they're playing around with my brain. They're bringing the four quarters of my brain together. They're moving me on. She then had visitations from her daughter who died about 6 years before. She said, oh, your sister came to see me. She then knew that Maggie had problems with her teeth. Impossible. There is no scientific explanation for this unless she's attuning into another field of information that we don't know about. But it gets odder, because children get sleep paralysis. When you were a child, did you have a mythical friend? Did you see things in the rooms? Did your children have mythical friends? I believe that what is taking place is elderly people and young people, their doors of perception are more open than ours are. Children get Charles Bonnet syndrome. It's just not diagnosed as Charles Bonnet syndrome, but they do. In the book, I even suggest a neurological reason as to why they get Charles Bonnet syndrome. Their corpus callosum is not fully developed, the thing that holds together the right and left sides of the brain. It's not, and the nerves of the brain, the neurons of the brain, are not myelinated. That means effectively that they are not insulated, which means the signals can leap out into the environment around them. And they sense and they see things. They see things that we don't see. And children get very frustrated when you turn around to them and say that you're seeing unusual things. In my new book, I'm researching this, and the amount of cases I've found of children who have encounters with ethereal beings, entities, UFO encounters. I'm particularly fascinated at the moment in owls, the way in which owls seem to have this huge symbolism within children's UFO encounters. The owls are clearly screams that the aliens, or whatever we like to call them, hide behind. Because, of course, what does an owl look like? It looks like an alien, doesn't it? So, children. Now, this is where it starts getting creepy. These drawings that children make of the creatures that they see when they're in these states. What does that look like? What did my mother see? Here's more. But not only that, I didn't have time today, but I came across an absolutely uncanny series of cave paintings from in South Africa. Wall paintings that were done 20,000 years ago. Exactly the same as these. This is because our ancestors, their doors of perception were more open than ours are. This is why they lived in the world they do. This is why they lived in the world of shamanism. This is what shamans do. They just open their doors of perception and it becomes broader. As I was saying with children, the corpus callosum band of nerve fibers that connects the left and right sides of the brain grows and myelinates rapidly during early childhood. This effectively means that because your brain is not communicating fully, it means that it's more open to communication. It's more open to the communication to the broader informational field that sits outside of us. Again, everything I'm saying thus far is all referring back to actual known academic papers. Don't forget that. I'm not saying anything. I'm not channeling this from the planet Tharg. I'm not because the guy down the pub says he's interested in UFOs. I'm doing this through the science. All I'm doing is joining the dots. And I genuinely believe I'm the only bloody person on the planet doing this. This is a guy called Dr. Barry Riceberg. Riceberg has come up with a hypothesis called retrogenesis. And what is retrogenesis? Retrogenesis is the fact that you can actually plot the development of a child, and then you can plot it the other direction as a person deteriorates into death. There's a literal one-to-one relationship. The one thing that fascinates me, which I don't talk about, something called on here, is something called the Babinski stimulation, which I tried on my mother when she was catatonic in the last few weeks of her life. If somebody tickles your foot, your foot will curl round like that, because you're an adult. You do that to a child, the toes go upwards. I tested this with my mother. She had a baby's child's Babinski reaction. Her body was reverting back in reverse to childhood. Have you ever noticed when somebody, when they have Alzheimer's, as they get more into it, they revert back, they look more and more childish, then they become a fetus. My mother at the end was a fetus that was curled up. She's going back. She's going back because she's going to do it again. Now, not a few of you here have actually read any of my work, but I have a concept called cheating the ferryman. And I do the science of cheating the ferryman, and I can explain deja vu, I can explain near-death experiences in its entirety. I know that I was checking downstairs, and one of the magazines down there that was waxing lyrical about a guy called Robert Lanza. Robert Lanza came up with almost identical hypothesis to myself with a tenth of the science 4 years after my first book came out. But his book, Biocentrism, is supposed to be the greatest book ever. That's my little bitterness coming out of there. Okay? So, retrogenesis shows there's a full circle coming around here. Okay? But then it gets stranger again. There is something called late onset persistent deja vu. This is a known fact and it is a known phenomenon. As people get older and go into Alzheimer's, they start to get the most phenomenal deja vu sensations. They feel that they have done all of this before. They stop watching TV programs because they know what the end is going to be. The hypothesis is it's to do with the way the brain is breaking down. Well, that explains how somebody can see the future, doesn't it? So the brain's chemicals are causing chaos. You tell that to somebody who knows what's going to happen next. Now, I've worked with people who have deja vu for many, many years. Deja vu is one of the things that really fascinates me. And I've worked very closely with a guy called Vernon Nepe, who's at the Pacific Institute in North America, and also a guy called Dr. Arthur Funkhauser, who's the world's leading expert on deja vu and the deja phenomenon. We're all in agreement. This is evidence that we live our lives again. And the fact is, deja vu are actually memories. You're remembering from the last time you did it. Of course, the hypothesis, the general explanation is to it. In fact, there are 72 different explanations for deja vu. None of them are right. None of them are stating the obvious of actually asking the person what they're perceiving. The person perceives that I have done this before. Now, if you have a deja vu sensation now, some people will argue that it's evidence of past lives. Okay. If you have a deja vu sensation now, that's not evidence of past lives. That's evidence of the fact you have sit here today in March 2019 in a hall in Burgess Hill wearing the clothes you are wearing now, surrounded by people wearing 21st century clothes. That does not prove that it's a past life. It proves that you're remembering something you have done before. It's as simple and as easy as that. The general hypothesis, and if you go to most of the books on psychology, they will turn around and they will give you the explanation. It's called the visual pathways hypothesis, and it was put forward in 1962 by a guy called Robert Efron. The reason this doesn't work anymore is the work of Akira O'Connor. The Robert Efron hypothesis argues that, remember I was talking about how the visual fields work, it means that the peripheral vision of each side of your eyes, so that both hemispheres of the brain have binocular vision, you get one side of one eye feeding in and the other side of the other eye feeding into one hemisphere and the opposite sides into the other one, which means they get signals from both eyes. Gives you stereo vision. The argument is that the signals get confused on the way in and there's a slight delay as the signals go past, and the signal enters your subconscious non-dominant hemisphere slightly before it hits your dominant hemisphere. The signal then crosses the corpus callosum, so you get an echo. You get the image, and then you get the image again. It's the visual pathways hypothesis. That doesn't work anymore. The reason it doesn't work is quite simple. Akira O'Connor has actually worked with individuals who have had and were born blind, congenitally blind. They have what's called déjà entendu, already heard. They will hear something and then they'll hear it again. Completely different, different pathways in the brain, the whole thing is different. Déjà vu is a great mystery. I used to do a regular program on BBC Radio Emergency.
Sorry.
It's all right, déjà vu. And a guy phoned up, in fact I've got the recording, I'll put it on Facebook sometime if BBC will allow me. And a guy phones up, because we have phone-ins, and the guy phones up and he said that I was the first person that actually really described his sensation, because what happened was he was sitting watching television with his wife, and he knew what was going to be happening on the television, he knew what people were going to say next. So what he did was, he got so frustrated, he stormed out of the living room, and he went past his front door, which was glass, and he saw people walk past, and they walked past again, a bit like the cat sequence in the film The Matrix. He goes upstairs, or he sits on the stairs, and then he realises he can prove he's been precognitive. Quite simply. He waits until he knows what his wife is going to say when he walks back into the room, and he wrote it down on a piece of paper, and went in, and as she said it, he handed it to her. Power. Proof. Because, of course, most people that have general déjà vu tell me, and people who have temporal epilepsy, and people who have classic migraine, and various other individuals tell me they have it a lot. There's one lad I know who has a tumour on his pineal gland, and he's consistently déjà vu. And when I asked him once, why, if you've got a déjà vu and you know what somebody's going to say to you, why don't you say it to them? You know what he said to me? Well, that's stupid, isn't it? Because if I turn around and tell them what they're going to say, they won't say it, will they? Yeah. And it's true. He said, effectively, I will switch universes. The moment I do that, the universe, which is the outcome of what I'd seen, would cease to be. Now, again, in my books, I talk about the Everett Wills interpretation of the Hugh Everett III, many Wills interpretation of quantum physics. Again, all the things I'm saying now, I can explain them using physics and cosmology. I can explain them. Okay? So, persistent déjà vu. So, elderly people, they're just déjà vu all the time. And they're déjà vu because the memories of their past life are starting to well up in them again. They're starting to remember. How many times do you hear elderly people say, I'm getting all these memories from my childhood that I'd forgotten. I'm remembering things in detail I'd forgotten. It's because you're about to go back again. You're about to become a child again. The memories are falling through because it's part of your immediate future. When you die, you come back as yourself. But not like Groundhog Day, and not like you live the same life again, and this is the difference. Okay, I'll touch on that in a minute. I'll just discuss the idea of the principle. I believe, and it's in my other talks I talk about this, this is a computer simulation. We are existing in a simulation. I know that people talk about this all the time, and I know Elon Musk talks about it, and very other people talk about it. I'm one of the few people actually doing the science of what this means. There is strong evidence that this is a simulation. Not only that, there's strong evidence that everything you physically see around you is made up of information. It's made up of data. Everything is mathematical. What we think is physical reality is created for us. Okay? How is it created and how is it formulated? Well, what I'd suggest again, if you're really interested in this work, there's a guy called Jacob Bekenstein, who is an Israeli physicist, who's been doing work on stuff called Hawking radiation, and the implications of the second law of thermodynamics to do with black holes. If you throw a computer into a black hole, information is lost. That is impossible within an enclosed system, if the universe is an enclosed system. Contravenes our knowledge of physics. They believe that what takes place is a facsimile, and the information in that computer is smeared on the outside of the black hole. Not only that, but they believe that the inside of the universe itself, imagine the Big Bang, the universe expands outwards. It's like a huge balloon expanding, isn't it? They argue that the actual inside edge of the universe is actually peppered with Planck square lengths of things that actually project digital information inside. We are existing in a two-dimensional hologram, but we have the illusion of space and time. Okay, again, haven't got time to go into the detail of this, but imagine the scenario that you're living in a computer simulation of your life. Imagine the scenario, I don't know how many of you here have ever played third-person computer games. You know, when you switch on the computer game, a little creature appears on the screen, and she's a little girl, and she's running down corridors. You make her run down the corridor, she goes into a room, big monster comes out and kills her. She's dead. She gets reborn again. Okay? But she's dead. But she gets reborn again as a new version of herself. But you're the game player. So you remember what happened in our last life. And the new version of her doesn't go into that room, doesn't die, and goes a bit further along the corridor and gets killed again. She dies, she goes back to the start. You remember. You have, and each one here of us has a game player. It's a being I call the daemon. You might call it your guardian angel, your guardian spirit. That voice in your head that says to not do something, that voice that recognizes somebody that you've never seen before and you end up marrying them. That sensation you have when somebody feels just wrong. This is your daemon. Precognitive dreams are there for warnings. Deja vu sensations are there for warnings. This is your daemon guarding you and warning you. This is your game player. This is the universal you. This is your you that exists outside of time and space. This is the real you. We are called Eidolons. We are in the game. We die, but the real you doesn't, and the real you carries that information forward. Now, within the computer program, every single outcome of every decision you can make in your life is already programmed in there. Not only that, but every decision your parents made and your grandparents made. If your parents decided they were going to emigrate to Australia and didn't do it, there is an element of the program which you can relive at some stage in the future, in your own future, where you did fulfill that growing up in Australia. There will be alternatives where certain illnesses and diseases that people had will not be there. Sounds crazy, but again, the physics, I do the physics, and I cite people like Stephen Hawking and various other people, the implications of the work they're doing. So this is telling us that reality is far more peculiar than you can ever imagine, but also that it's invigorating and lifting. Don't we always have that thing, the things we've done in our past where we think, I wish I hadn't done that? Because we know how it spins out. But wouldn't it be wonderful if the next time you get there, a part of you remembers that, oh, no, no, don't do that this time. No, do that instead. It's Groundhog Day. Remembering Groundhog Day, Connors? That's what he does. Every day he learns, he has more information. He doesn't live the same day. Every day is different. The circumstances, the environments are the same, and his body's the same, but he does different things. He teaches himself foreign languages, he does lots of things. What's the ultimate aim of this? to win the game. And you win the game when you have exhausted all the life opportunities that you feel, I've now done it all. I've seen it all, I've read all the books I need, I've fulfilled all my desires. And then you move on. And then you properly move on to whatever is outside of this. I also believe that all this happens in the split second before you die. I've written a book called The Labyrinth of Time about time perception and how time expands. Anybody involved in a car crash or anything when time just goes? That's to do with certain neurons in your brain. It's to do with certain neurochemicals in your brain. That's what happens when you die. Time slows down. Time stops. You die as far as other people looking at you are concerned. But you don't. Not in your own mind. Again, I'd strongly suggest, if anybody's interested in the implications of this, a guy called Max Tegmark, who was a Princeton physicist, he has put up a thought experiment called quantum suicide, which is very similar to the thing I'm putting forward here. You can prove scientifically that you are immortal. It can be proven scientifically. It's an application of something called Schrödinger's cat. Have you ever thought of the fact that in your life, you see other people die, but you don't? I know it sounds a peculiar statement, but you're still here. You have friends die, you have family die, but you're still here. Because you are. Because this is the universe that is you. Doesn't mean it's solipsism, doesn't mean that other people don't exist. It just means that there is this incredible mixture of how thoughts and ideas work. I could go on, but I'm not going to go on anymore about that. Let's move on quickly to the final thing. This is something I'm really, really excited about. It's an event I'm going to be involved in on Saturday the 27th of April 2019. The full details are on my website and on my Facebook page. But just to explain, Drakelow Caves, the Drakelow Tunnels. Has anybody heard of Drakelow? Oh, excellent. Good. One person. You're the first person who's actually ever heard of them. Fascinating place. Okay. They were... Drakelow itself is a really, really weird place. I was up there about 2 to 3 weeks ago, testing out the caves and the tunnels themselves. It's in a village outside of Kidderminster. And Drakelow is a hill. It's a sandstone outcrop. And it sits really oddly around the surrounding countryside. The word Drakelow is from Anglo-Saxon, and it means dragon's hill. This is the Anglo-Saxon version of a dragon. This is not a dragon as in a fire-breathing Game of Thrones monster. It's a kind of a spirit, a protective spirit of the land. It is on a series of ley lines, the hill. But there had been Upper Paleolithic borings into the hillside for centuries, and the place had a reputation for being terribly haunted. And in fact, literally yesterday, I looked into the history of the place, and apparently in around the 11th century, there was an incident there which like seems to be straightforward out of a modern-day zombie movie, where two guys who died actually turned up in the village and were wandering around attacking people. And this happened supposedly in the 11th century, so this place is terminally odd. But during 1939-1940, the British government realised that this place could be used, and they employed Rover cars to actually drill tunnels into the hill. There are 5 miles of tunnels in this building. This was all only declassified 5 years ago. And I'll tell you a reason why it was declassified. The tunnels were all the way through. People died making these tunnels. The reason they did this was they realized it was bomb-proof. And they employed somewhere in the region of 2,000 people who worked for the whole of the Second World War putting Spitfire wings together. And it was a total secret factory. I believe this is the reason why Coventry was bombed. I think that Hitler and the Luftwaffe were looking for this factory because they knew that somewhere in the Midlands there was a factory. They couldn't find it, so they bombed Coventry instead. Because they couldn't find it. At the end of the 70s, they had hospitals down there, they had a school. One of the areas is as big as this, and they had Vera Lynn singing there for them, and Churchill came to visit them. There is a hospital, there's an operating theatre. There are canteens down there. It is just an incredible place. When the Second World War ended, the nuclear age took off, and the atom bomb. They realised they had a bomb-proof nuclear shelter. So they turned it into a Cold War nuclear shelter. This was the place that Princess Anne and her family were going to go to if nuclear war took place. Apparently there was a plan that there would be four or five of these places and the royal family would be dispersed. The reason they placed it here was apparently if the Russians bombed us, they would take out things like Spaghetti Junction, they'd take out all the motorways, they'd take out all the railways. But what they couldn't take out was the canal system. And this is at the confluence of a lot of canals. So they could move and transport people using the canals. They then made it bomb-proof. So you go down there now, there are actually the rooms where the people were listening into the Russians and things. It's bizarre. You wander around, you think you're like you're in a zombie movie. Believe me, it's the freakiest of places. So, it gets declassified about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's owned by a local farmer now. Now, I know that Most Haunted have been down there, and when I went up, I went round with one of the PhD researchers who's working on it, and he was explaining to me the phenomenon they've seen down there. They have regular poltergeist activity. In fact, at one stage, one of the poltergeists followed him home, and he said he was doing research at home, and things were flying around the room because the entity had followed him. But the weirdest thing he told me was he was in the edge of one of these corridors, and as they were walking along, they heard bang, bang. There were noises and bangs. And one of them turned around and said, "Are you something that can hear us?" And he went, "Bang, bang." And then one of the guys said, "If you can hear us, what's two and two?" And he went, and they went, "Oh, shit." Then one of the guys, and I stood in the place where this happened, he decided that what he would do is he'd throw an empty can of Coke, and he said, "If you can make things happen, I'm going to throw this Coke down this corridor. Throw it back at me." So he threw it into the darkness, and he told me he heard it bounce, and then he heard it bounce again over here. And it came down another corridor. So he threw it down one corridor, and it materialized down another corridor. Now, by this time, I've got shivers going up and down my spine, you know, because I'm standing there in the place this happened. He then showed me on a phone a photograph that had been taken of the point we were standing. And there was an old deserted canteen. And it's pitch black. And he shows me the photograph. And we're looking in the direction of this door. And in the photograph, in this doorway, is what I can only describe is a human figure made of stars. It's standing there, it's got green light. And it's like a speckle of stars. And you can see the shape of the head and everything. And he said, "That we saw, and it came out on a photograph." Now, what we are planning to do is that, I don't know how many of you are aware of the ancient Greek Eleusinian mysteries, but what used to happen was people would march from Athens to a place called Eleusis, which is about 12 miles away, and they would do, it was a cult of Pan, it was the cult of Demeter, and they would take mild altering substances such as ergot, and they would go into altered states of consciousness, and they have these huge celebrations and this bacchanalia. And then during this time, there would be people who would be speaking in tongues, there would be people who would be making predictions. And the goddess Demeter would appear, and she would bring her daughter Persephone from the underworld. Because don't you remember, Persephone gets stolen by Hades, and every six months she's allowed to come back, which makes us the summer. Okay? We're going to reproduce this. But not only are we going to reproduce this, but we're going to reproduce this in a really, really weird way. I've been working for the last 8 years with two researchers from Austria, Dr. Engelbert Finkler and Dr. Dirk Prokop. Has anybody heard of the lucid light device, Lucia? Okay. The Lucia is simply the most amazing machine I have ever seen in my life. It's a light machine that uses stroboscopic light, and it uses different shades of white light. You sit in front of it and it brings about altered states of consciousness with everybody. I know of nobody that has not had and been placed into an altered state of consciousness with this. It's been built from the bottom up by a consultant neurologist and a consultant psychologist. So we're not talking about people playing around with these things. These guys know what they're doing. There's been research done on these machines. We know there's research being done on the machines recently at the University of Sussex. And we know that the part of the brains that light up if people take magic mushrooms, psilocybin, exactly the part of the brain lights up after 6 minutes on one of these machines. It reproduces what takes place with magic mushrooms. Now, I believe that during the time of the ancient Greeks, they were actually taking ergot. They were putting themselves into altered states of consciousness. We're going to place people into altered states of consciousness. We're going to have about 6 or 7 of these Lucia machines. People are going to be taken into an altered state of consciousness. We're then going to put them into something called holotropic breathing, which brings about altered states of consciousness. Then we have something called Wave 7. Wave 7 is a developing piece of virtual reality software that reproduces the out-of-body experience. A virtual reality with a virtual reality headset. So you're going to be in a virtual reality and you're going to have an out-of-body experience. So all these three things are going to be working together with these people in these caves. Then my role is to come in as Master of Ceremonies. And I'm going to take people on a tour of the caves. And then we're going to get to a certain point and we're going to reproduce the myth of Plato's cave. Does anybody know the idea of Plato's cave? Okay, the idea of Plato's cave is an ancient Greek myth, ancient Greek thing put forward by Plato. And he said, imagine a scenario that a group of prisoners have been held in a cave, staring at the back wall of a cave for all of their lives. And they're chained and they can't move their heads and they can only look at the back wall. Behind them is a walkway, and behind that is a fire. People walk along the walkway with cardboard cutouts of animals. The people can only look forward and see the shadows on the back of the cave, on the wall. They take that for reality, because that's all they've ever known from the moment of birth, is the back wall, and that's reality. Plato said, imagine a scenario that one of the people manages to break his chains, look behind him, walk past to the entrance of the cave, and sees reality as it really is. And then walks back to the other people, who are still staring at the front, and says, you're not going to believe what I've seen. This is not the world. This is an illusion. There is a world behind this world that's huge, and it's wide, and it's wonderful. Would they believe him? Of course they wouldn't. They consider him to be insane. And that's what I mean by opening the doors of perception. Thank you. Right, so we have, Andy, I think we have till 10 to 9, don't we?
Yeah, you've got a
while,
yeah.
Okay, so what I'd like to do now is to throw it open to the audience, because this is the bit I always enjoy the most, is just audience feedback. Questions, experiences, thoughts, ideas. I'm talking complete nonsense, you can contradict it, that's fine, I don't mind, I'm not here. I'm not saying that I'm right, all I'm saying is that the evidence seems to suggest this. So, anybody want to kick off, if you can speak loudly?
What are your thoughts on dimethyl tryptamine?
DMT, wow, well, what a brilliant first question. Okay, I believe dimethyltryptamine, does anybody know what dimethyltryptamine is? Okay. It's the most powerful hallucinogenic substance known to man. My previous book and this book has a whole section on dimethyltryptamine. And I know a lot of the major researchers in the world working with dimethyltryptamine at the moment. It brings about, there's a guy called Rick Strassman. In the early 1990s, Rick Strassman, who was a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico, was given money by the American government to do research into dimethyltryptamine. And he had some in the region of about 70 volunteers who were intravenously given this substance. And the idea was they would tell people what happened to them. They had the most extraordinary circumstances. They found themselves, as a friend of mine who's taken dimethyltryptamine and 5-MeO-DMT, if you know about that as well, which is even more powerful, They said that what takes place is it's like suddenly you're shot out of your body at great speed. And this friend of mine, who's a research psychologist, told me, he said, I felt like I came out of my body, was shot out, and I end up in this place. And he said he just felt, oh my God, I'm back there again. And then he finds himself back again. Now, there is research being done as we speak at Imperial College, I think it is, on dimethyltryptamine. And again, one of the guys that's involved in this event is one of the guys involved in the research. And he's one of the guys that's been taking DMT legally. And he was explaining to me, it's going to be in my book, this new book I'm writing, and he was explaining to me, he was saying, he takes the DMT, he goes out of his body, and you end up with something sometimes known as the DMT cage. It's a kind of a location, like in space somewhere. Only, everybody takes DMT, that is more real. The DMT world is much more real than this. Everybody who takes DMT says, this is the illusion, not that. And he said, he's in this cage, and suddenly this creature, this alien creature, comes to the edge of the cage and prompts it and says, you shouldn't be doing this. This is not the way to do it. Do not do it again. So he said, I then come to, and I explain this, and he said, 2 weeks later, I do it again. I'm in the bloody cage again. And the same creature comes over and he said, I told you last time, do not do it this way. This is not how you need to do it. Because people have entity encounters when they do these things. Now, what is peculiar about DMT is that there's a substance called ayahuasca. And ayahuasca is a substance that is taken by the shamans in the Peruvian Amazon and Amazonia in general. Two mysterious things about this substance. The first one is that it is made up of two plants mixed together into a brew, into a tea. Banisteriopsis tapi and Psychiatra viridis. Psychiatra viridis contains the DMT. Banisteriopsis tapi, they were a bit confused about. They didn't know why it was mixed together. So they started doing research. Now, if you take the leaves of Psychiatra viridis and you chew them, however many you eat, you will never, ever have an experience. The reason being, they go into your stomach, and your stomach realizes that these leaves are in there, and it excretes something called monoamine oxidase. And what the monoamine oxidase does, it stops the DMT crossing into the bloodstream through the lining of the stomach. Then they found that Banisteriopsis tapi contains something called harmaline. Harmaline is a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. So when you pick the two together, the MAO starts to come out, but the inhibitor stops it, which allows it to go into the bloodstream, which allows it to go up into the brain, across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. The anthropologists were quite intrigued and asked the shamans and said, there are 80,000 different types of plants in the Amazon. How did you get the two plants that coincidentally work together without any knowledge of chemistry or any knowledge of biology? You did that. The shamans nodded and said, the plants told us. And they said, what do you mean? And they said, well, when our ancestor shamans used to go shamanic traveling, because of course a shaman can get into these altered states of consciousness automatically, they would be shown by the snakes. The snakes would show them that the snakes would appear, and plants would appear. And they'd lead the person in the dream sequence and point at this plant and that plant. Pick that, put it together, and you will allow ordinary people to have shamanic experiences. Now that is absolutely uncanny, the more you think about that. And in my new book, I'm going to argue, I know what the snakes are, I know what the plants are. It's DNA. It's our DNA talking to us. Anybody had a Kundalini experience, or know of Kundalini experiences? Okay, Kundalini experience is something shoots up your spine, from your coccyx, right up your spine. The symbol for it is two lines of force called the Ida and the Pingala. And it's two snakes that go round each other to the top. If you look at the symbol of that, you see it everywhere. It's the caduceus. It's the symbol that doctors use, it's the symbol that masons use. You see it on every single Masonic lodge. This is because these guys know what is taking place here. And a final point about DMT is I believe that the Lucia light device actually stimulates endogenous, that is internally generated dimethyltryptamine. We synthesize DMT in our bodies. You'll go out of here and you'll mention this to other people and people will turn around to you and they'll say, Anthony Pink's talking nonsense. DMT has never been discovered in the brain. DMT has been discovered in the brain. A lady called Jimo Borjigin of the University of Michigan 3 years ago discovered in the pineal gland of live rats DMT. Now, how do I think the DMT is synthesized in the brain? I think it is to do with the fact that the pineal gland stimulates something, creates something called melatonin. Melatonin is the substance that makes you go to sleep. People take melatonin tablets when they're doing transatlantics and things. Melatonin can be synthesized into dimethyltryptamine. They're both amines, they both have a very, very similar structure. They have an indole structure and they're very, very similar. That can be created. I think our own pineal gland creates it. My final point about this, and I tend to go on because I was really intrigued when I discovered this. At the 49th day of gestation, the baby in the womb, now 49th day of gestation for anybody who's interested in Buddhism is when the Buddhists believe that the soul enters the embryo. At the 49th day of gestation, the pineal gland and the pituitary gland sit at the back of the throat in a little substance, that thing called the ephesis. From the 49th day, the ephesis moves up through the centre of the brain to where the pineal gland and pituitary gland sit in the centre of the brain. It leaves a tiny little thing called Rathke's pouch. Okay? In Indian traditions, and in Sufi traditions, and in certain mystic traditions, there's something called Kakara Mudra. Kakara Mudra is training yourself to place your tongue at the back of your throat. You do that so when you're in certain meditative stage, you taste something called the nectar of transcendence. It is an acidic taste that is at the back of the throat. I argue that what they're tasting is DMT. And what happens is the DMT is synthesized by the pineal gland and drips down Rathke's pouch to the back of the throat. And that's what they're doing when they're tasting it. So, long answer to a short question.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, can I just ask a really simple question? The guy that was in the cage that went back twice and the alien prodded him.
Yeah.
Why didn't he ask what was the right way? If this is the wrong way, I would have said, well, can you tell me the right way?
That's a very good point, and I will ask him because I'll be seeing him next week.
Thank you.
Yeah, because that's a good point. I think he was so taken aback and terrified. You think the first time, the second time, he would listen to what the creature was saying.
Yeah, I would have just asked.
Because funny enough, people, friends of mine who are in the esoteric traditions, and I have a lot of people involved in esoteric work, do say that, you know, really, DMT is not the root. DMT, you're being fooled. I mean, for instance, people say when they have DMT or ayahuasca encounters, they encounter the dragons and the entities. The entities will turn around and say, we are the masters of the universe. We do this, that, and the other. And apparently when some guy came back after he'd done this, he spoke to one of the local shamans and he said, no, they're not. They say that everywhere. They say that all the time. Don't believe them. They're bullshitters. Okay, any other questions?
I'd like to ask about speaking in tongues. How do you make sense of that?
Right. Xenoglossia. Is it Xenoglossia? It is Xenoglossia, isn't it?
Glossolalia.
Glossolalia. Thank you. Thank you. I think it is to do with, again, another area I'm fascinated by is, does anybody know Tom Hicks, the comedian, Bill Hicks? Bill Hicks once did a very famous monologue where he turned around and he said, breaking news, young man on acid discovers that reality is actually, matter is just energy slowed down to slower speed, and we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. Now back to Bill Weather. The point he was making here is something called, I suppose the term is pandeism. And the idea is that we are all one singular consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. Now what I mean by this is, and this is moving into theology rather than pure science, but it's the idea that if there is a God, what would he do with his time? And the argument is he could create a simulation reality and then exist within it. But exist within it as the people in it. But in order to make it valid, he has to exist within it, not knowing that he's God. And he embodies himself in everybody, like living in his own soap opera. So he lives everybody's lives. In which case the idea find God within is because God is within. Now, what then idea is, if we are one singular consciousness, it means that there is totality of memories of all of us, call it the zero point field, call it the Akashic record, the Akashic field, whatever we like to call it. But that means, and it's probably within our DNA as well, that we will probably know other languages. That we will probably be able to structure language in some way if we can attune into those parts of the brain or the field. So we start speaking in tongues and speaking in languages. Because my work has always been, I'm very much a syncretic writer, I'm very much interested in both the theology, the belief systems. I don't dismiss any experiences, I don't dismiss any religion, because I think they all have validity. As Aldous Huxley said, something called the perennial philosophy, which is the argument that in the end, all religions boil down to the same belief system at the core. It's just that times have changed and we've moved on. And I believe this is the way forward, where science, mysticism, and religion can actually work together. I mean, I've invited to speak with Sufis, even Mormons invited me to speak to them, because they say, you know, you're talking Mormonism. And then I had Sufis come to me saying, you're talking Sufism. I've had Buddhists come to me to say, it's Buddhism. I've had Hindus, you know, so it's quite curious. But again, a long answer to a short question.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
People in the tunnel chucking coke heads.
I'm sorry?
When they were in the tunnels and they were throwing coke heads,
yeah.
Again, like this lady said, when they thought, oh, we've got someone they can meet, what kind of questions did they ask
it? They could only get the bangs, and it then stopped, apparently, he told me. But he's now working with this. He's actually doing either his PhD or his postdoctoral research on this subject. Because the thing is, the question is exactly what is communication? I'm a member of the Society for Psychical Research, and I've been quite interested, and I wrote a book with Irving Laszlo on mediumship and communication with are we talking to the dead? What are we talking to when people go into mediumistic trances and these kind of things? And I've worked in the past with people from the Stanford and Fitcher Hall who train mediums as well. So I'm very intrigued as to what is taking place here. But it is a good question. You always wonder why people don't ask the obvious.
And has it shown up since?
He said that they've heard things, but nothing definite. Yeah. But I only spent around about an hour and a half with him. I'm supposed to be meeting him on Tuesday, but apparently he's trying to get a grant for something at the moment, so he will be coming down to London on Tuesday, because we're supposed to be doing the, how we're going to do the linking together of the things. But, okay, but yes, good question.
Just a shared experience, actually. I had sleep paralysis and was a 10-year-old, and I saw my work to my mum as Humpty Dumpty was with a dragon.
And you remember it still now?
Oh yeah.
Can you still visualise it in your mind's eye?
What happened was I was in my bed and I felt something pop on the bed. We didn't have any cats or anything. And I looked to the bottom of my bed and I saw this thing. And it petrified me. And I seem to remember things covered over my head and it didn't disappear, it just went. I don't know how it ended up working.
This is the thing that intrigues me. I'm doing the research of my new book, and I'm doing a whole section on children's encounters with entities, with goblins and fairies. And what intrigues me is just how it's like a cosmic trickster. You know, things are utterly, utterly crazy and ridiculous. There's an American writer called Siri Busfeldt, who, like me, is a classical migrainer. And when she was a child, no, she wasn't a child. I think she was probably in her 20s when this happened, I think. She said she was sick, that's right, because she was writing a book. And she said suddenly the doors opened in her room and a little farmer with a little cow walked in, pulling the cow. And the cow was mooing and everything else. And then this little police car came round. And policemen got out, arrested him, put him into the police car and drove out through the room. And she's going, what was that? What was the point of that? It's almost as if there's a kind of a joker taking place, as if, you know, somebody's pulling your legs somehow. Now that, again, just shows the vivid imagery that takes place here. I mean, I'm fascinated by lucid dreaming. I'm fascinated by out-of-the-body experiences. What is taking place there? You know, are they really outside of their body, or are we in some form of alternate overlapping reality that is part of this one and not? But it seems the doors of perception are open with children, and then they get lost when you get to 9 or 10. And then it seems to fade away, but the memories continue, as they self-evidently do. Thank you for sharing.
I had one incident, but it was very, very good.
Excellent, thank you. Martin first, and then back to this lady.
Yeah, hi. Off the back of that, because I've had quite a lot of sleep paralysis throughout my life as well, and I kind of noticed gradually, you know, quite a similar way to kind of scary, repetitive nightmares that you have when you're younger, and then when you confront them, they do actually, that's how they quite often go away. With sleep paralysis, I noticed it was that kind of, there's a panic and a resistance because of the state that you're in. There's a correlation, for me anyway, with the more you kind of manage to calm and relax yourself instead of panic, you then seem to gravitate towards the ability to then lucid dream a little bit better. I was just wondering if there's any explanation potentially towards that you might lean towards?
I believe there is a direct link between lucid dreaming and sleep paralysis, and I believe that it is to do with how the brain is processing the dream sequences in some way. I mean, I managed to come lucid for the first time in my life about a month ago in a dream. I've never ever managed to do it before, and it was quite a surprise because I was dreaming I was in a nightclub, and I came out of the nightclub and I was walking down the side of the nightclub, and then for some bizarre reason I suddenly thought to myself, I'm dreaming, and bang, I was lucid. And I remember thinking, right, what are you supposed to do now? I said, you're supposed to fly, aren't you? So I left my feet up and I fell to the floor. I banged my knees. And then I tried it again, and suddenly I found I was floating up. And then I floated over the back of the... And again, these things are so vivid that you're in your mind. And I floated over the back wall, and I floated over and realised at the back of the nightclub, there was a bay. And I flew along the bay. I could feel the wind in my hair. And I could see cars driving along the side of the bay. And then it happens. Then you think, this is just crazy. And then you wake up. So lucid dreaming is very, very powerful. A friend of mine, again, if you join me on Facebook, there's a friend of mine who's posted, he's a filmmaker, a Spanish filmmaker, and he's doing a series of films on lucid dreaming and going to alternative realities. Very, very good. They're very, very excellent. They're good. Right.
We need to finish.
Okay. Okay, thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.